Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Well, hello everyone from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio. We hope everyone is having a great evening. It's rather tropical here in the fine state of Indiana, a little warm, but hey, we'll be thinking about these days in January and February and realize that it wasn't quite that bad. We have a great show tonight all the way from California, the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Jim Koval is going to be joining us. We're going to be talking sharks tonight, everybody. Perfect timing with all the, the stuff on the Discovery Channel. And we're going to set everyone straight. This is going to be a fantastic hour, so we're really looking forward to it. And tonight, not only being a studio producer, but also my co-host, because she is such a shark fanatic, Melissa Hovey will be joining us in just a few minutes as we grill Jim about the sharks and all the new developments at the aquarium. They have some very exciting new things to tell us about, and makes everyone want to go to Monterey Bay Aquarium. As always, the technical engineer, Wayne Larson, handling the music, Jim Johnson, and from his massive Wild World News studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, the honorable, distinguished, and sometimes humble, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Sometimes. Well, good evening, Mr. Batson. We've been enduring it the last few days, haven't we?
I'm sorry?
We've been enduring with the heat the last few days.
Oh, enduring is right, but as I said moments ago, we'll think about these days in January and February and long for them again. So it's going to be.
Yeah.
You know, that's the wacky world of Indiana. We go from one extreme to the other, and now it's the other, I guess. But anyway, the following portion of Larry Batson's Wild World is brought to you by Alphabet Swamp, the new children's book by Cheryl and Larry Batson. Order your autographed copy today at www.larrytheanimalguy.com or send check or money order for $10 per copy to WES 4140 North, 600 West, Greencastle, Indiana, 46135. Shipping and handling included.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News for September 1st. Now, as you all know, just a week ago, our state capital endured a 5.8 earthquake. Now, it damaged some of the monuments there and some buildings. But now here's the interesting thing. The National Zoo there in D.C., Washington, D.C., documented a broad range of animal behavior before, during, and after the quake, which was last Tuesday, I believe. Now, a gorilla named Mandara shrieked and grabbed her baby. Kabibi is the baby's name. And I raced to the top of a climbing structure just seconds before the ground shook. Now, the red-ruffed lemurs emitted an alarm cry 15 minutes before the tremor. Now, a lot of the animals reacted strangely. The snakes went nuts, and their large Komodo dragon ran for cover.
How fascinating it is, Dr. Day, though. It is the primates that anticipated before the event occurred. And then the other animals reacted after the event. But the
right. Primates. So your little olive baboon, maybe you should keep her a lot closer to you. Maybe you should sleep with her so you keep an eye on her in case something like this happens here.
Well, that's probably true. It's pretty much an earthquake around her all the time anyway, so it doesn't much matter. Okay.
All right, now we watch these little guys grow up on the Internet. Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Three eaglets that hatched this spring as millions watched online have left the nest. Now, one was fitted with a satellite transmitter, which has allowed the researchers to track its growth. The eaglet, listen to this name, D1, stayed close to the nest atop a tree at the Decora Fish Hatchery until just a couple of weeks ago. And then the Raptor Research Project Director said that she just took off.
Wow.
Now, I think I know where she went.
Where did she go?
Well, you know the Steve Miller song, Fly Like an Eagle?
Yes.
To the sea. She went to the sea, right?
There
Fly
you
like
go.
An eagle to the sea.
That's why you're a doctor.
That's right. Now, this is going all across the United States due to the drought, and a lot of places are going through a drought right now. Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Wildlife officials say sightings of snakes are on the rise amid the drought there. Now, it seems the snakes are seeking water are likely to turn up in, the residential gardens there. Now, the Oklahoma Wildlife Department said that that the homeowners should keep their lawns cut short and get rid of any brush piles.
You know, it's been the opposite here, though. We've had this hot, dry summer, and I think I've seen, and we live in the country, everybody. We live in the middle of nowhere, and I think I've only seen 3 snakes this year total. So it's been kind of a...
That's pretty unusual.
Yeah, it's very unusual. Usually I'll see one every other day, but this summer, no.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, have you heard the expression prairie dog in it?
Yes, I have.
Okay, well, they know the expression in Cedar City, Utah. The Parowan Airport will use federal and state grants in an attempt to keep prairie dogs from burrowing through the runway's asphalt surface.
Oh, that's not good.
Yes. Yes, now. Yeah, good luck with that. Now, one possible plan is to install barriers 8 feet deep along the runway.
Oh, that might work. Yeah.
They could,
they could introduce some ferrets. That could...
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
I'm surprised, you know, with all the air traffic, that they wouldn't think there were large birds of prey. But no, they want to burrow through the asphalt.
Well, that's too bad.
Now,
but you know what we always say... They were there first.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's their land.
Yeah, it's their. Yeah, that's right.
You ever had a kite stuck in a tree?
Well, many, many, many years ago.
Well, I guess in Oklahoma, that if your kite's stuck in a tree, they jump out by themselves. Now, listen to this story. More than 200 young hawks rescued from the heat and drought are to be released this month. 226 Mississippi kites, which is the type of hawk,
right,
were about 2 to 4 weeks old in their nesting period, which began around the 1st of August. Now, apparently, they jumped out of their nest as temperatures continued above 100 degrees. 222 of these little birds.
Wow.
Yeah. He was thinking maybe something else is going on.
Yeah, that's you know, we've had a lot of weird bird behavior these past few months. It just continues on.
All right, well, let's see if we can help out these people in Searcy, Arkansas. Now, the police and animal control say that at least 7 coyotes have been seen within the city limits in the past month, but there are no reports of the animals approaching people yet. Now, the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission has issued police a permit to trap, good luck with that, or kill the coyotes in the city limits. Now, I was thinking, what if they got a recording of a mountain lion, played it over their PA systems, drove through the city streets? Now, I know the cats and dogs would probably stay in the house for a couple of days, but, you know, wouldn't that be better than, you know, firing a weapon inside the city limits?
Well, why don't they just ignore the coyotes? They that's be the simplest thing, and explain to these people that coyotes are quite frightened by people.
For some people, no,
and they're not a threat. So that would be the smart thing to do, but that's a government thing, so that probably is not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, if you've listened to our show in the past, you know that we reported on the smelly corpse flower a couple of times. Well, here locally, at the Western Illinois University, corpse flower is getting ready to bloom. A smelly corpse flower will bloom in the next 2 weeks. The Titan arum flower at the Botanical Sciences Botany Greenhouse has bloomed twice since 2010. Now, the greenhouse gardener says that this bloom appears to be smaller than the two blooms they had last year, but he's sure that it will stink just as well.
And it will draw hundreds of thousands of
and people. Hundreds. What a weird response. Rotting flower.
Yeah, that's yeah.
Well, have you heard that a former guest of Batson's Blog Talk Radio and a good friend of ours could possibly be running for Indiana governor?
I had heard that. Rupert.
That's right.
Yeah.
The first TV show Survivor winner.
Mm-hmm.
Good friend of ours, former
yes.
guest.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about running for governor.
Well, we're definitely going to have him on. The only problem is
that
we'll have to have every candidate on that wants to run for governor. But...
All right, well, before we end up with the news tonight and bring our guest Jim out, I wanted to do my own personal shark story, one of my shark stories.
Okay.
When I was going to college in Panama Canal Zone, at the Canal Zone College, and Fort Amador there was a fort which had three different military bases on it, and there were three little islands about a mile off of Fort Amador, and the military built a causeway out to them. Well, on one of the little islands, they put in an officer's, a military officer's building for the officer's wife and kids. They made a beach area. They put up shark netting so that the people could swim there.
Right.
When we would go out to the causeway, if there was a low tide, which sometimes there on the Pacific side, the tide would go out as much as 17 feet,
mm-hmm.
You could see the shark netting very well. It was mostly uncovered.
Mm-hmm.
There would be sharks stuck in the net trying to get in. There would be sharks stuck in the net trying to get out.
God.
And yes. So I'm not trying to ruin anybody's vacation, but because there's shark netting. And that's about all I had to say. Also, Old Farmer's Almanac says the next 2 weeks are the best for fishing, and Melissa Hubby will be glad to hear. Shark Night 3D, new movie, premieres tomorrow night.
Okay. So that's the news?
The Wild World News for September 1st.
Oh, wow. Once again, an outstanding job done by Dr. Henry Day. We want to tell everyone to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and our brand-new Facebook page, Larry the Animal Guy and Friends, filled with photos and information about our animal family. Also, RadioMom.fm and the home of the Radio Mom Shop, where you can save 50, 60, 70% on vacations, restaurants, and a variety of other goods and services. And why not listen to my show, The 70s on Sunday, 12 to 7, each Sunday at RadioMom.fm. Also, the exciting new kids fishing show, iKids Fishing. It's put together by We Want You Cottages up at Chautauqua Lake in western New York. It's the first kids fishing show starring kids, teaching kids how to fish. 40 million fishermen spending, get this, $45 billion a year. The iKids Fishing Show is a keeper. Here's their website, www.wewantchu.com. Hit the link on the website, iKids Fishing, and you'll see how exciting it is. And why not take a trip up to western New York, go fishing at one of America's finest fishing resorts. Also, McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. We call it God's country, everybody. Go to their website, info@McGregorMountainLodge.com. Those are our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio. all the way from the Monterey Bay Aquarium, way out in beautiful, sunny California. He's got a long title. He's Senior Manager of Guest Experiences. He's the great educator there of all marine life. Jim Covell's with us. Good evening, Jim.
Good evening.
It's great to have you on the show, and I apologize to you earlier that we played a theme from Jaws, which probably did more bad public relations for the shark world than any one film could even possibly.
I still get the heebie-jeebies every time I hear that. I just...
Well, I'll tell you who also does, and I caught a little slack tonight co-hosting the show, Melissa Hovey, all the way from her home in Ohio. Good evening, Melissa.
Good evening, Larry. Good evening, Jim.
Good evening.
Well, Melissa's got a co-host tonight, boy, because she is the shark expert in this little quandary we have here besides Jim. I want to kind of go along for the ride. I have to tell you, though, before we get started, you have some very exciting news, Jim, about a new exhibit at the aquarium we want to make sure we start right off with here this evening.
Yeah, this is pretty much breaking news. The aquarium just put a great white shark on exhibit this morning. And it's a young animal that came up from Southern California. It's kind of a cute little shark, as white sharks go. It's 4'7" long and about 43 pounds. And made the trip up here well. And it's the sixth great white shark that we've had here over about the last 7 to 8 years at the aquarium.
What a great public relations tool that is.
Yeah, for people to, everybody hears about great white sharks, and of course we see the images in the media that are usually, you know, the really big toothy ones, and to actually see a young white shark and to see it up close and personal, you get a whole different sense of what these animals are all about. They aren't nearly as big and scary as they're made out to be, and so that's why we're really happy that we can introduce people in person to a live great white shark, and they really get a more true impression of what these animals are about.
Do you remember the feeling you first had when you actually touched one? And I'm sure you had an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, the first one to touch was here at the aquarium, and because we brought the first great white shark. Other aquariums had tried to keep them, but we had the most success. Most other aquariums had to release them after a couple of weeks, and our first shark stayed with us for over 6 months. Just to be that close to the real thing, and understand that they are a superbly crafted ocean predator by all means, but they have a real vital role out there. And you know, they're not out there as big killing machines that are just out there to get us. They really have a pretty vital role in the ocean. And there's something about connecting with one that close, not seeing them on television or on the movie screen, but seeing them for real, that sure made a big difference.
Well, and two, you know, there's millions of people that are in the ocean every day. And the amount of times that there's some type of conflict with these animals is like, I mean, they have a better chance of being struck by lightning.
Absolutely. And actually, as we spend more time tagging white sharks, looking at white sharks from spotter planes along the coast, they're probably around us a lot more than most people imagine. And if white sharks had any proclivity to interact with people, they could they have plenty of opportunities, but they've shown us over and over again that they pretty much mind their own business. They're out there looking for their particular food, and that's not us. And so humans and sharks actually share the same space a lot more than most people would imagine, and it's rarely an issue.
I can still remember a good friend of mine laughed. He lived down in Bradenton, Florida, and one of the most popular places, the beach is there at Clearwater. He said it's one of the, you know, hammerheads supposedly are notorious for, human confrontations. He said it's full of them, and the people realizing when they're wading and flopping around in the ocean that these things were just thick as thick as can be, and he just laughed about it every time he'd tell me about that.
Yeah, sharks really, they are they're around, and they have amazing sensory capabilities, both in terms of smell and picking up on vibrations, and then that remarkable electromagnetic sense they have. We don't have anything that begins to touch that. When there are sharks around, they easily know that we're in the water as well, if they're anywhere around us. And again, they show little or no interest in humans.
Well, for something that's supposed to be so primitive, they sure are very, very sophisticated. That's all I can say.
And you know what? I've thought about that because we know that the lineage of sharks goes way, way back. There are shark ancestors going back, we think now, maybe close to 400 million years. Sharks have been around a long time, but that doesn't mean that they stopped changing millions of years ago. They kind of split off from other fishes way back then, but they have continued to evolve and to modernize, and sharks today are pretty sophisticated animals with some amazing capabilities. So that I'm not sure they really deserve that image as being real primitive kind of ancestral creatures.
Well, absolutely. I know Melissa's biting at the bit to have some questions and things that she wants to discuss. She's been very excited about tonight's show. Melissa?
Thanks, Larry.
You bet.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about tonight's show. I've been waiting for this since last year, since Shark Week was over with and I talked to Jim. First of all, Jim, I want to go back to that new shark that you guys have on display down there at the Monterey Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, first of all, how long will you guys have the shark in your facility before you actually start to try to learn anything from it? I mean, is there like a time period where it just kind of gets to know the facilities and what happens, or how does that process work?
Well, we really, and to be honest, we've already have some history with this shark. Before it came here to the aquarium, the shark has already been involved with our field program down in Southern California. Every summer, we have scientists out working around the Santa Monica Bay area where these juvenile white sharks are fairly common. And we have a big 4-million-gallon floating net pen offshore there. And so this shark's actually been with us in that net pen for a couple of weeks. We've been watching its swimming pattern and its behavior. It's been eating down there. And so we've already got to know it a little bit. And that's absolutely essential. The shark really has to convince us that it's going to be a good candidate to come up here to the aquarium. And so yesterday it made the trip up here and went on exhibit this morning. And from the time it goes into the exhibit, that learning process really kicks into high gear. We have staff and volunteers that watch that shark literally 24/7 and make notes and observations about swimming behavior and interactions with other fishes. And we're measuring how much food it eats and making some guesses about how much energy it's expending at any given time. So the opportunity to watch a great white shark up close and personal like that is such a rare scientific opportunity that we really don't waste a minute. And for as long as that shark is with us, we'll continue to keep those kind of detailed records.
How did the aquarium happen to come get this shark into the facility? I mean, because usually you talked last year about how, you know, when sharks get tangled up in the bycatch nets and things like that. How did this shark end up with your facility?
And we used a little bit different strategy this year. In past years, because local fishers down there in the Santa Monica Bay Area have had young white sharks get tangled in their nets from time to time, and how this all started was we set up the net pen, and as they had sharks tangled in their nets, they would bring them over to us, and we'd watch them for a few days, and if they were in great shape, we would tag them and release them. And we realized that the one drawback is you never know if that shark was just tangled in the net a few minutes ago or if it's been there for long enough that maybe it's, we know that sharks are very, very sensitive to oxygen levels in their blood. And even with lower oxygen levels for just a few minutes, we can start to see some signs of brain damage. And So we realized that the sharks that we inherited from fishermen down there weren't consistently really robust animals. And if we were going to invest either tags or invest the time to bring an animal up here, we needed to really make sure we knew exactly how the animals were handled. So for the last year or two, we've had a purse seine boat with us down there. When we find a juvenile white shark, the purse seine is actually, the seiners wrapped a purse seine net around it, and we gradually close in that net and then bring a boat alongside where we can literally lift that shark out of the net and convey it directly over to our net pen and put it in there. So it's only out of the ocean for a few minutes at most, and we know exactly what kind of care that shark got from the time it left the ocean to the time it went into our net pen. So that's how we got this one, and we've had we have a lot more confidence in the health and vitality of the animals when they're handled that way.
Are the scientists at the aquarium able to estimate the approximate age of this specific shark?
And with aging, we can only make a really rough guess. And we know that white sharks are 3 to 4 feet long when they're born. This one being about 4.5 feet long may be a very young animal. It may be less than 6 months old.
Wow.
And again, that's still a pretty rough guess. But based on what we know, that's our best guess at this point.
Okay, and this question has been asked to me before, and I don't have an answer for this, to be honest with you, so I'm going to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
How do scientists, shark scientists, go out into the oceans and estimate the populations of breeding adults?
And that's, up until about a year ago, nobody had a good answer for that, and now we do. Thanks to the work of some scientists connected here with the Monterey Bay Aquarium and Hopkins Marine Station, Stanford's Marine Lab that we work very closely with. There's been a study going on for several years. It was finally just published late last year, where scientists have found that the dorsal fins on great white sharks, when you look at them, each dorsal fin has a particular pattern to them. The trailing edge of the dorsal fin gets worn away or gets nicks out of it, and that tends to be individual for each shark. And the sharks have been photographed enough, especially the large adult white sharks that gather around the Farallon Islands. We've been able to photograph them now over a number of years and to identify specific individuals. So scientists have identified 130 separate individuals that are part of the population here in Northern California. And then using some formulas that have been applied to other species in kind of tagging and recapturing studies, you can estimate the total population from the number of known individuals that you see on a repetitive basis. So from that, the estimate now is about 220 adult white sharks here in the kind of central Northern California coast. And that really threw a lot of people. They thought, well, maybe there's hundreds or maybe even 1,000 or more out here. And it turns out it's really just a couple of hundred adult white sharks. That's not really a very large population.
So was that scary for you guys when you heard that, when you figured that out?
Well, it's like, a couple hundred individuals, that's not a lot of genetic diversity. If some... I'm not sure what kind of disaster would befall sharks, but if suddenly people started fishing, or even if poaching increased dramatically on that shark population, even taking a handful of animals out of a population of 220 can really put a serious dent in the population. And so it means we really need to take care of these animals. They're not nearly as numerous as we might have thought.
We're talking sharks tonight, everybody. Our guest all the way from the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California, Jim Colville, and he'll be back in just a few moments. Folks, you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you. Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, 1 second, I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face-to-face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess. Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Here's a hot topic about our wildlands and living with the natural role of fire.
Yard work is not just a matter of pride when you live in the wildland-urban interface. It's also about survival. Here are some FireWise tips that can help protect your home from wildland fire. Prune your trees 6 to 10 feet above the ground. Remove dead leaves and branches and dispose of them before fire season. Water your lawn regularly and store firewood away from the house. Be prepared for a fire emergency by having a plan for your family and pets. Learn more at our website, and then sit back and enjoy. You worked for it.
This hot topic was made possible by the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation. Learn more about the natural role of fire, how to protect your community, and get the latest fire information. Visit the National Interagency Fire Center website at NIFC.gov. That's NIFC.gov.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
This is Larry Batson with Larry Batson's Wild World. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Jim Covell from the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California. We want to tell everyone that next week on the program, Yellowstone Park Ranger Bob Jackson is going to be back on the show, a friend of the show. We're going to be talking all about grizzly bears, do a little positive PR for them because there's been a lot of negative here in the last few weeks. And those same bears that have created problems, supposedly, we'll say, Mr. Jackson may know on a first-hand basis, spending close to 26 years patrolling the backcountry of Yellowstone National Park. So it's going to be a fascinating show again next week, so we encourage everyone to tune in. We also want to tell you that all of our shows are available online at www.blogtalkradio.com/Larry-Batson or Google Larry Batson's Wild World. You get right to the site, and you can download any show, including tonight's, absolutely free of charge, and we encourage you to tell your friends and do just that. We also want to tell everyone that underwriting tonight's show, Tire Service Plus and owner Jerry Jones taking care of America's auto maintenance needs. They keep her animal truck on the road, traveling thousands of miles with her wild animal ambassadors. Give them a call. Say, hey, thanks for helping out. 317-243-0700. And also all the individual underwriters that contribute make it possible for us to be on each week with these marvelous guests that we've had, and we appreciate every donation that we do receive. Go to my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and you'll see contributions. Make that contribution. Leave your name, as Jeannie Harrell did and Harley Gines of San Diego, California, and you'll be an individual underwriter. Our guest tonight, Melissa, introduce everyone once again to our guest, if you don't mind.
Tonight our guest is Jim Covell from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. He's the gentleman that handles guest experiences out there. He's the head of it. He knows all there is to know about sharks. Isn't that right, Jim?
Well, I'm getting there. There's so much we all need to learn about sharks.
Oh, well, come on.
Well, go ahead, Melissa.
Well, I was just going to ask you really quick, because I have a local question here. Somebody I know wants to know, how long are you going to keep the juvenile shark on display?
And that's a good question indeed, and I have to say ultimately the shark is the only one that can answer that question for us. When we bring in one of these, especially the great white sharks, because we're the only folks that have kept them, and this is the sixth one we've had, so we're all still pretty new at this. So our policy is to really monitor that shark closely, and as long as it's eating well, as long as it's getting along with everybody else in that big million-gallon open sea exhibit, then it will stay with us until it gets to a sufficient size, and that's typically around 6 to 6.5 feet, maybe 120 pounds. That's about the largest white shark that we can safely handle to release from the exhibit. So, and that's been the case typically with our sharks is they do very well here, and eventually they get pretty close to that upper limit where we need to release them. If they get much larger, then it's getting risky for us and or the shark to handle them, to release them. So if all goes well and the shark is healthy and it's playing well with everybody else in its exhibit, then it'll be here for at least a few months. The longest we've kept one is about 6 months. And although this is one of the smaller ones we've had in, so it's got some room to grow. So who knows? It could be 6 months or more if all goes well.
Now, earlier before we started the program, you had said that there was some new and exciting information out now about great white sharks. One thing that I had heard this year, which I thought was just really interesting, is that when the juvenile sharks are born, they stay in the areas down, well, we're talking about the California coast here, near what, Malibu and things like that, and they don't eat mammals yet. They still eat fish and things like that. Is that true?
Right. From a lot of the, and now a number of years of tagging sharks and being able to observe them, we find that the juvenile sharks, say 10 feet and less in size, tend to stay in warmer water. And for this population, that's Southern California and Baja California, and maybe up into the Sea of Cortez. And from a number of animals, around 100 juvenile sharks, or excuse me, probably about 43 that we've tagged juvenile specifically down there. We've seen that pattern pretty consistently. So the younger ones are staying down there, and there they feed mostly on small fishes and smaller sharks and skates and rays. And then they make a big switch at about 10 feet, 9 to 10 feet in size. That's when they start to look at shifting their diet, eating marine mammals, maybe small seals and sea lions, and that's also when they move into cooler water. So that's the time when we see them move north here into central California and join this population of adults. And then their dietary preference changes also. And they seem to look for a diet with more fat in it. So marine mammals are a great source of blubber for them, so they really go for seals and sea lions. Elephant seals are a very popular item, and they'll even forage on whale carcasses that are adrift out here in the ocean.
Yeah, that's actually pretty interesting because, I mean, if you think about it then, I mean, technically the great white shark is not a fast-growing animal. It's actually pretty slow. Is that about right?
Yeah, they may, early in life, they might grow up to 8 inches to a foot per year, but that slows down pretty dramatically. So some of these individuals we see up here in the Northern California, that again, that population around 220 animals, might be 15, 16 feet long, and they could be 25 years, 30 years old.
Well, do they have any idea yet how young or how old a female great white has to be before she'll start to mate and reproduce?
We know so little about white shark, great white shark reproduction. I think most of the females that we've seen that are pregnant or gravid are in that 12 to 13 foot long range. So, you know, they're probably at least 10 or 12 years old, maybe upwards of 14, 15 years old.
Wow.
So, yeah, it takes them, as with many sharks, it takes them a number of years before they really hit reproductive age. And that's one of the big issues where, for a lot of species of sharks, we humans are biting a lot more sharks than they are biting humans. And we're eating sharks, a lot of them, before they even have a chance to get into their reproductive years. And so that really damages the population pretty quickly.
Yeah, And you bring up a really good point there. You know, we're biting more sharks than they're biting us. You know, a lot of people have asked, I've heard this question, you know, thrown around quite a bit, but tonight let's dispel this myth. What is the most dangerous shark to humans?
And I think from the documented shark attacks where they can identify the shark that attacked the humans, probably bull sharks have the probably have the number one spot there. They're a coastal species throughout many parts of the world's oceans, and they're also known to go up into fresh water. So they have the opportunity to bite people not only at the beach, but also up into freshwater rivers as well. And I think they probably have the record. Tiger sharks are a close second, and then white sharks would probably have to be third. And again, depending on the source you talk to, they may put those in different order. But those are probably the big three that humans would ever be concerned about.
Well, you know, I mean, when you think about it, when you look at a bull shark, I mean, bull sharks are not really, they don't grow as large as a great white. So I can see where people would think, you know, a great white would be far more dangerous than a bull shark. But I've seen more people get attacked in shallower water or heard of it from a bull shark than I have a great white. Do you think that, because, you know, this year during Shark Week, they made a big deal about shark attacks. Great attacks off the coast of Africa and Australia and things like that. I mean, do the scientists there at Monterey Bay think that white attacks are on the rise?
I don't. I haven't heard anybody really say that there's any more white shark attacks than normal. And really, for white sharks, because their range is limited, their population is limited, so you know, compared to something like a bull shark, where there's a lot more of them spread over much, a much greater geographic area, there's just a lot more opportunities for people and bull sharks to interact. And with white sharks, it's again, the number of white sharks has increased over the last couple of decades. The number of white shark attacks has increased over the last couple of decades, but it's because the number of people out there in the ocean surfing, swimming, snorkeling and so on has increased dramatically. If you looked at the percentage of white shark attacks compared to the number of human days in the water, it's still remarkably low.
Yeah. You know, I'll be honest. I mean, last year when we did this program and we talked about, you know, the various sharks, I have to say you gave me the startle of my life, and I think that this goes back to, you know, just, you know, the reputation that the great white has with people, and people don't educate themselves about the various types of sharks. I mean, you really gave my heart almost a flat line when you told me that lemon sharks are off the coast of Puerto Vallarta and that they do bite people, that they are not just a docile animal, because the people at the hotel, they don't tell that to people. They said that they're perfectly safe and you don't have to worry about it, but they're there. You know, I wish that there would be more education about these animals and the truth.
And it's, you know, I think we should realize that sharks are present in a lot of waters where we humans hang out. But again, the other part of that reality, they're more than you might expect. But also, they have so little interest in interacting with people. When there is a case of a shark biting a person, it's very often either we've done something that the shark takes as an aggressive action, so it's kind of a defensive reaction for the shark, or it's mistaken identity. I know certainly for great white sharks, it's nearly always a setting where there are other marine mammals in the water. You're out there in a wetsuit or paddling on a surfboard, and you look like the world's tastiest elephant seal or sea lion. And so the shark comes up for a taste test. And that's the other thing that, you know, when you look at shark attacks, sharks don't eat people. They bite people. And that's rare, but on the rare occasion when a shark does bite somebody, you know, they instantly realize that they made a mistake, and they swim off and go look for something that they really want to eat.
Right.
That bite, you know, that little taste test can certainly cause you some problems out there in the water. But, you know, sharks don't come back and consume their victims. So that, again, that confirms that it's a mistake when a shark bites somebody.
Okay, before we started the program again, you know, you had said that you had some new information that's been gathered by your scientists there. Anything that you want to share with our listeners?
Well, probably, again, the work we've, as we get more and more results from the satellite tags we've been putting on sharks, we're finding now, for example, that the sharks here on the California coast around the first of each year leave the coast, and the vast majority of them head off towards the Hawaiian Islands. But only a handful of them get to the Hawaiian Islands. Most of them spend their winter and spring months in a big area kind of nicknamed the Shark Cafe, about midway between San Diego and Honolulu, and that they are hanging out there for several months, and then it is until maybe July or August that they start to move back on shore again. And that's something that we didn't have a clue that movement was going on. We just know that we didn't see any sharks on this coast during certain months of the year. And now, thanks to the tagging work, we're getting a much better sense of what their life is like throughout the year and their that big migration out into the ocean. The tagging has also told us that sharks that live in South Africa will swim over to visit sharks in Australia and back and forth. And again, that was very new information. So the tagging is really revealing some amazing things about these animals.
Well, what do your scientists think there about the reemergence of the great white out in the Atlantic?
Because of tagging, now we're able to track these animals in the Atlantic a lot more, and it comes down to a question of, have they always been there and we just weren't aware of it, and now because we have the ability to really observe their movements out in the Atlantic, we have a better sense of where they do turn up. And so I'm not sure if it's maybe it's just we're realizing where these animals go, where they spend their time. It's just we have the means to really observe that now. Maybe it's been going on for a long time, and we're just getting clued in now because we have the ability to track them around better.
Well, you know what I found interesting, you know, by watching the shows this year, is that they were tagging them off, you know, like Massachusetts and mm-hmm. up in that area where the water's colder. But then they noticed that they were swimming down south and berthing, or they think they could be berthing off like North Carolina coast and Georgia and things like that. And I thought, you know, that's really interesting because I'm not a shark scientist, but I'm noticing a parallel with California. You know,
That mimics what we see here with younger animals. And remember that great white sharks are one of a handful of fishes that are warm-bodied animals. They actually, most fishes are cold-blooded, so their internal body temperature is the same temperature as the water they're in. Not so for white sharks. They have some pretty elaborate physiological heat conservation mechanisms that allow them to maintain a warmer core body temperature. So they're pretty sensitive to the water temperature around them. And what we think is going on is the same thing we see with whales, where the parents want to give birth in warmer water so their young don't exert as much energy fighting the cold water. They can invest more of that energy into growth. And then when you're really big and robust, then you can live in cooler water and still maintain that warmer body temperature.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and they've even noticed a boom in the population of seals off the coast, like up there near Massachusetts and things like that. So, I mean, I think it's pretty exciting to be hearing that they're coming in back to, you know, to the Atlantic side, to the east coast of the country, and then to hear about all the work being done that's been done for so long. Are your scientists at all active in the whole shark finning issue, you know, trying to get a stop put to that in American waters?
we've been very active at that here, and actually I'm happy to report that the aquarium helped to sponsor some legislation here in California this year that would, and shark finning has been illegal in California waters for many years, but it was still legal to import and export shark fins in California, and so some new legislation was introduced that made it illegal for the most part to even possess shark fins here, and you couldn't sell them in California. And I just saw that in the last week or so that legislation had been approved by our assembly here, and it's headed for the governor's desk for signature. So that may become law, and there are several other states, Hawaii and Oregon and Washington, I think, are already there. So one by one, a lot of states around the country are outlawing this very wasteful practice of shark finning. And so I'm happy that the aquarium played a role in promoting that legislation here in California.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, honestly, God bless you and the scientists there for doing that, because that has to be one of the most heartbreaking and disgusting practices I've ever seen in my entire life. I mean, it's, to me, that's just heartbreaking that somebody could do that to an animal, regardless of what they think the image of the animal is.
And it's so wasteful that, the fins are taken and these sharks that are going to live for many hours or days longer are cast back into the water with no ability to move or propel themselves or navigate. And they just lay there helpless until they die. So, yeah, I think we all like to see that practice come to a close. And hopefully we're getting closer to that day.
So are your scientists there pretty excited about what your new little shark is going to tell them?
Yeah, this affords new opportunities, once again, to observe in detail just growth and development of a young white shark. And when you can measure how much food that shark eats every day and you can start to get a sense of how much energy they expend, then you can put together like energy budgets and how much energy does a white shark really need to stay in business and to do different things. And what a shark does in an exhibit is going to be a little bit different than what they do out in the ocean, but it's as close as we've ever been able to come to really making those kinds of calculations and getting that kind of information that makes us at least we're able to make better guesses about how these animals operate out in the wild.
And one final question about this juvenile shark that you guys have there at the aquarium. Have you named it?
Haven't given it a name yet, and you know, we may not. For animals that we're going to release, and we know we will release this shark in some months, and so we really don't want to get too attached to it. And so it doesn't have a name yet, and probably remain that. For some of our animals, we give them numbers, but since there's only one white shark here, I don't think we even have to give it a number. It's pretty clear that it's the one and only. And
well, I'm assuming here that you've kept the original tag on it, or was that removed, and will it be tagged again?
We actually removed the tag that was because when animals go into our pen, we tag them so that we can release them at any point. And when we decided that the shark was going to come up here, then that tag was removed. And it'll be retagged before it's released out in the ocean so that, again, we can track it like we have all the others. And I'm happy to say that our past five sharks we've released with tags on them. And, again, the tags have told us those animals have gone down south. They've all done very well for the year that the tag was on them, with one exception. We had one white shark that we released that had spent time with us here in Monterey, and it did well till it got down into Baja California, and actually then it was turned up as bycatch in some nets with fishermen down in Baja California, and that one perished. So that was unfortunate, but our other sharks have made it out there.
Okay, here's a two-part question here, really quick. How many sharks currently does the aquarium have tagged? And I forgot the second part of the question. Currently, how many sharks do you guys have tagged?
Through the years, we've tagged Now, just looking at these numbers, we've got about 43 juveniles that we've tagged down in Southern California waters, and about 250 tags that have been placed on adult great white sharks here. And now I said that we estimated only 220 white sharks lived here in Central California. So those 250 tags we've put out actually includes retagging a number of adults also, where maybe the batteries have played out in a tag or the tag has fallen off and we have retagged them. So we've got probably a good portion of the adult population wearing tags now here in California, and some portion of the juvenile population in Southern California.
And the second part of the question was this: can people still view the returns from the tags online through the TOP site, or is that not functioning anymore?
No, you still can, and you can go online to TOPP.org and look at tags not only on white sharks but on over 20 other kinds of marine animals out here that are wearing these satellite tags that allow us to study their movements from albatross to blue whales to leatherback turtles. And boy, it's given us so much insight into what these animals do out there in the ocean where we haven't been able to follow them. But we don't need to chase them around now. We can let them carry tags around and let the tags report back to us.
Yeah.
Pretty much the development of electronic technology is going to save this species.
It's opened up a whole new world for us in terms of being able to get more insight into their lives, that's for sure.
Well, Jim, I would probably say that you're one of the people that it's a joy to go to work every day.
It's, it's something new and exciting. And when I have a day like today, when I walk in and the first thing that greets me is a new great white shark, those are pretty exciting days.
And there's probably a point in your life where you said, man, this job is just way too cool.
I have to pinch myself a lot of days am I really here and do I really get paid to do this?
Absolutely. Well, I have to tell you, I've learned more tonight. What fun for me to be an audience to the conversation we've had for this hour and the expertise that you have shared with us. While you were talking to Melissa, I was kind of thinking, is there some information that you guys keep close to the vest that you don't want the general public to know?
Gosh, because we pretty much try and share as much as we can. That's how marine science in general moves ahead, is just everybody being pretty open with what they discover. And so I can't think of anything that really we're kind of keeping mum on at this point.
Yeah.
A couple days ago, it might have been that we might have a shark coming up here, but I can tell
right.
you that now.
Well, I was thinking these dastardly shark fishermen that would know their migration rates and that sort of thing. That's what I was.
Yeah, and I do have to say when we show these things online, where these animals are going, for some species like tunas, it's delayed by a day or two. So that. Give the fish a little bit of a sporting chance out there.
Well, Jim, we want to thank you. Gosh, Melissa, what a fantastic job. Your love of sharks, great job tonight.
Well, I probably feel a lot like Jim. It's not really a job when it's something that you enjoy talking about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, we want to thank you so much for sharing your time with us tonight. It was thoroughly, not only educational, but what great work the Monterey Bay Aquarium does. And as Melissa said, and I feel the same, and God bless you guys for all the hard work and, of course, your work toward the legislation to exterminate the shark finning, which we've talked about several times on the program. I stand up and applaud the efforts and work that you do out there in California.
Well, we're pretty passionate about it, and hopefully we're making a difference.
I would say you are. A wonderful show tonight, Dr. Day.
Incredible show. Thank you so much, Jim. And Melissa, great job.
Absolutely.
Hey, do we know if your great white is a male or female?
It's a male.
It's a male.
Yeah.
Well, fantastic. We want to thank all of our listeners. I want to thank Melissa Javier for co-hosting tonight, and, of course, Wayne Larson, Jim Johnson, Dr. Henry Day. Next week on the program, Bob Jackson, Yellowstone Park Ranger. We're talking grizzly bears, so it should be a fascinating hour as well. Big thanks to Jim Covell from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Folks, this is Larry Batson, and you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.